you know, people who have a problem with original sin, they fail to notice or to attend to the fact that they would do exactly what Adam did. that there isn't a person on this planet who would default to trusting God. It's just how, I think it's just the fact of where we are.
Right.
You know, if we're given the opportunity to have all the answers up front and just make our own choices, we're going to do it. So God used Adam as the problem. You know, how do you allow one man to be the redemption for all people? One righteous act to count as righteousness for all people, unless their problem is that one ungodly act, one sinful act, put them in their predicament.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. We're back, and we are trying to recover faith by recovering the faith.
Yep.
And we're in a series about that. Essential Faith, Recovering Faith. Forgot the name of our series.
It's called Redefining Faith.
Redefining Faith.
Yep.
And today's topic is, today's title is Paradise Lost.
Oh, yes.
Which, of course, is a reference to sin, you know, the fall. And this idea of original sin, which Christians learn about in school and in church. And what we're trying to do in this series is break down misconceptions and correct those misconceptions. And so today, we're going to say, and Nathan, I'm going to need you to explain this. Sin, the misconception, is that sin is an affront to God's authority and judgment as the exercise thereof. Now, that's the idea of original sin in its misconception. All right, you're going to explain why there's a misconception in that statement.
Right.
Because people are going to hear that and go, well, that sounds religious to me.
Yeah.
That sounds like the Bible and theology to me. And then the correction is that sin is rather an approach to life demonstrated through transgression, which God orchestrated to bring about sin's demise. Oh my goodness, that's kind of deep. Sin as an approach to life demonstrated through transgression, which God orchestrated in order to bring about sin's demise. Okay, so let's go back to the beginning and let's talk about original sin.
Original. Yeah, you go ahead.
Well, original sin, you know, people are thinking that's the fall. That's Adam and Eve in the garden.
Yeah.
That's part of people's thinking. About what, that's what part of what comes to mind when you say original sin. Another thing that comes to mind is human nature. It's just a reference to human nature. We all have these inclinations. People who are not Christians, who are not particularly religious, will still sometimes refer to original sin as human nature.
Okay.
Like we're all fallen and we all sin. And somehow or another, every one of us is that way.
Yeah.
There's no exceptions.
Yeah.
And that's due to original sin, or that's what original sin is. Okay?
So do we sin because we're sinners, or are we sinners because we sin? What do you think?
Do we sin because we're sinners? That's sort of the common notion of original sin, I think. Or... are we sinners because we sin? Well, I think, like, grammatically, it's the latter. Like sinner, like, what is a sinner? It's a person who sins. One who sins. That's what a sinner is, grammatically.
Sure. Like a liar. Right.
Yeah.
Grammatically, yes. Forensically, though, right?
But in terms of Christian theology, the understanding is that the former. We sin because we're sinners. We sin because of something... sort of deeper, a deeper problem. And the sins we commit arise from a deeper problem.
Yeah.
Which we call original sin.
Right.
Sin, or sin nature. Those might be two different things, actually. Original sin and sin nature. But they sort of conflate, I think, in the common understanding.
They do, but there's really two aspects of it, and they're kind of important in... I don't know. I guess to some people, theologically, they're important, but they're also important in terms of just whether God is just or not. The idea that God is, if original sin is God blaming me for what somebody else did, which is part of the doctrine, mm-hmm. right? That I'm born, before I've done anything, I'm born guilty mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because of what somebody else did. Mm-hmm. And then,
which is why in the Roman Catholic Church, you baptize an infant
yeah.
in order to remove the guilt of original sin.
Right.
Because that baby's born guilty and we don't want that baby to go to hell
right.
if that baby dies.
Right, yeah. So there's that, which is how do you get there? But I'm sure that there's logic, right?
Let's and not get off track. Well, that's right. The, yeah, yeah. It's the logic that you just mentioned.
Right. Yeah. So the idea that we're guilty because of Adam's sin, and then the idea that we are wired to sin, that we have this tendency towards sin because of Adam's sin. That so you might say that there's a, you know, a legal model, and then there's a medical model.
Mm-hmm. Born guilty is the legal model.
Yeah.
Born broken, flawed, sick, diseased mm-hmm. is the medical model.
Yeah. Or mm-hmm. maybe genetic model or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, that's... And I think that there are some people who are comfortable with the latter and not the former. And the people who are comfortable with the former are, you know, the people who are comfortable with the idea that God holds people guilty for what Adam did, they tend to be very hardcore theologian types, you know, mm-hmm. Reformed theology, mm-hmm. like...
God said it, deal with it.
Right.
We're not talking about whether it's fair or not.
Right.
It's just what's there in the Bible, and so we believe it.
Right. Yeah. How do you know what's fair? You're a sinner. Right. It's like, what? Wait. You know, I mean, I can imagine somebody struggling with that. And
so you're going to take issue with the legal model.
No, I'm not.
Okay. All right. All right. So you're going to yeah. say it doesn't seem yeah. fair. There's an
it
issue
doesn't
there.
Seem fair. Yeah.
But you're not going to take issue with it.
Well, I can't. You know, okay. Biblically, I don't think I can.
Okay. So you think it's biblical? You think it's there?
Yeah.
We're born guilty.
Well, guilty or not, the story of the fall in Genesis 3, we're obviously all living with the consequences of Adam's sin. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's just say that, you know, God gives this man this opportunity to be in fellowship with him, share in his eternal community. Mm-hmm. Okay. And gives him a wife, and through that union, now there's a potential for a multitude of people to share in that union with God. Okay, so here are creatures that are made with the divine image capacity. Okay, so, but I think that they, in the garden, they're invited into not just the image, but the glory. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, something can be made in the image of something, but not have its glory. I think there's a distinction made there, okay? So that when Paul says in Romans 3:23, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, mm-hmm. that there's something we've lost, and yet humankind still is distinct from the rest of the animal kingdom in some ways.
Yeah, still in the divine image.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and on previous podcasts, I've said my concept, what I see in Genesis 1 and 2 is Genesis 1 is kind of this broad stroke, overarching poem to God's creation, beginning in very, you know, fundamental terms in terms of plant life, fish and birds, animals, you know, mammals, humankind, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So... farm, right? Mm-hmm. Fish, amphibians, reptiles, mammals, kind of a thing, you know? And it, ironically, it does seem to be that Genesis 1 follows that to some degree, okay? So to me, that looks like a global creation of a species of beings who, in that proclamation in Genesis 1, are created in the image of God. Male and female created he them, mm-hmm. okay? Then in Genesis 2, what we get is the camera zooms way in. You know, we're looking at the whole globe from Genesis 1. It's a watery ball, right? And we really see everything kind of depicted on a global scale. And then in Genesis 2, we're very regional, you know, really pretty much land of Canaan, looking eastward toward the Tigris, Euphrates, the Fertile Crescent. Mm-hmm. And there's this idea that these image bearers are now being invited into a very intimate literal face-to-face relationship with their creator, that he's breathed something into them, right? Mm-hmm. And that this breath, it makes them stewards over particularly this unique part of the world, maybe the whole earth, but at any rate, that there's this invitation into their full potential.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is the glory of God. When the Spirit breathes into this person and they become awake and aware, alive in a way that they've never been, you know, and that this life is now a choice, that they can continue in this relationship of trust, or they can grasp, you mm-hmm. know, there's this reaching, this grasping that is, I think, at the essence of sin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That
Paul seems to sort of hint at that in Philippians 2 in the hymn where right. he says, Christ didn't grasp.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
But rather,
emptied himself. Mm-hmm.
Did not consider equality with God a thing to be clung to,
mm-hmm.
grasped, but rather emptied himself. And mm-hmm. so he becomes what? The second Adam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's the essence of sin wasn't so much, you know, there. I don't think anyone's ever caused any major harm to themselves or others or to the planet by eating a piece of fruit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we think of wrongdoing when we do ethics. How do we define an inappropriate or improper action, something that should be considered wrong, maybe by all humankind, you know? And I don't know if culturally there is something that all humans everywhere have always considered wrong. I mean, things like, man, I don't know, but probably
murdering
most,
your parents, murdering your parents.
Yeah. Yeah. In most cases I would say, I don't know though. I mean, there's some tribal cultures that would say, you know, or maybe in Viking times, mm-hmm. right. You know, and your parents are getting to be, I don't know, 45 or 50 and mm-hmm. it's just, probably better for everybody if you throw them off a cliff, you know, maybe that was a good thing, right? You know, sorry you survived the wars, Dad, but it's time to go, mm-hmm. you know, got to go to Valhalla somehow. So again, you know, we can culturally create some sense of right and wrong in somebody very early on. And so when the culture begins to embrace a thing, it takes on the kind of the weight of being right or wrong. Ethics is very difficult, and that's why we got into this postmodern time. We're probably post-postmodern now, but this idea that your ethics are based on your narrative and your narrative is based on your culture, and so one person's culture is just as valid as somebody else's. You know, you hear people in the media talk about my truth,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so there's this idea that truth, at least moral truth or personal truth, kind of comes up out of culture. So then if that's the case, then who am I to say, right? And so how do we define right and wrong? What's the essence of it?
Mm.
These are difficult things, mm-hmm. and people talk about the moral law and how that points to God, but you know, that it just doesn't hold up all the time, right? Most developed societies had to have a level of civility or they wouldn't develop.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are tribal cultures around the world that, because they just never had the need, they were hunter-gatherers, there was plenty around them, they didn't need to grow grain and store it. You know, that phenomenon, growing food and storing it, creates values, property ownership, prohibitions against theft, it creates this idea of going to war is a glorious thing, but committing murder is a heinous act. You know, how do you protect your city state versus how do you take what belongs to the next people or ensure the security of your own property? Okay. So all of these things are somewhat of a function of survival. Certainly God gave these 10 commandments that we see, but, you know, to think that all people everywhere inherently know that bearing false witness against your neighbor is wrong, you know, when some cultures don't have a legal system, you know, that is that an inherent moral law? Is lying prohibited in the Old Testament in all cases? No. No, it is not. Deceit, deception, not prohibited in all cases. You know, David deceives when he has to. God even orchestrates a bit of deceit when Samuel's concerned about going and anointing David. And God's like, well, you know, take this heifer with you or whatever. Say you're there for a sacrifice, right? Gives him a cover story. You know, I'm not saying that we should deceive people. I think that, you know, ultimately we don't need to. But, you know, the age-old moral question, if you're hiding Jews under your floorboard and the Nazis come in, yeah, lie. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that the Bible gives plenty of space for that. Okay? So definitely lie about it.
So this is like an excursus on moral law.
Right,
where does it come from?
Right.
And you started out with sin as an approach to life.
Right.
Grasping versus trusting.
Yes.
And that's what leads to sins.
Right.
Infractions.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now you're off on this excursus on the moral
sure.
law. What is the relationship? But I'm just saying, where are you going with this? What's the
right,
point?
Right. So there is no moral law. So stop saying that. Because, you know, the idea, and I know that I'm going against like C.S. Lewis and others, you know, apologists and stuff who would say, well, because there's a moral law, then God must be real. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we start with, are there some things that you feel like are wrong for everybody, whether they believe it or not? My answer to that would be, there are some things that should be enforced, whether someone believes it or not. Mm-hmm. Because we're trying to maintain a civil society that will endure. And there are some things that have to be upheld mm-hmm. if to create a society that I want to live in. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's really pretty humanistic. That's just down here where we are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we need to ask, what kind of society do we want to live in? You know, do I want my wife and daughter to feel safe on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I want to be able to sleep at night without clutching a shotgun to my chest? You know, what kind of world do I want to live in? And shouldn't I behave in that way toward others so that I'm promoting that kind of a society?
That's the role and the purpose of law.
Right.
Even God's law.
Right.
Is your point.
Right. Right. Because the law comes only when they are becoming a nation. Right. I mean, God didn't say, hey, Abraham, I wanted to call you. By the way, I need you to take down some notes.
Mm.
Right? Right. You know, here's this Bedouin. He's got some people under his command, but ultimately what Abraham says goes. Abraham is the law for the people in his household.
Are you saying that we're not sinners because we broke God's law?
Right.
Okay, so the traditional Christian theology is that there's this God's law thing,
mm-hmm.
and it's written down in some cases, and in other cases it's just written on every human heart. It's
right.
It's the moral law.
Right.
And we've all broken that,
mm-hmm.
Which means we're all sinners.
Right.
We've transgressed God's law.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, your original sin backs up from there and says, well, we did that because we were born in sin, born sinners. And you have a different take on that.
And my take is that God, remember, we're invited into the eternal community. And what the gospel reveals is the righteousness of God.
For
by
in it,
what
the
standard
righteousness
is God,
of God
righteous?
Yeah, Romans chapter 1. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because
right.
it's the power of God for salvation. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from
right.
faith to faith.
Right. 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 And we've talked about how the Catholics saw that righteousness of God being God's own personal righteousness, whereby he judges sinners. We saw that Martin Luther saw it as righteousness from God, the mm-hmm. righteousness God gives. And the debate, I think what was wrong with the debate was that the belief that it had to be one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases in scripture, God is, you know, he's big enough that it's both. It's the both and. And I mean, John, if you read his works, he just all the time, double entendre. He uses words on purpose that are ambiguous, you know. And he's been critiqued, I think, by theologians over the centuries as being just a poor technician with the Greek language because he would choose a word that was ambiguous. So that's just like Aristotle used to critique Heraclitus because Heraclitus would do the same thing. You know, he would say, well, this guy's just obviously doesn't think clearly because he doesn't specify what he means. But these guys are missing the more sophisticated, nuanced argument that it's both. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we're dealing with the transcendent, and the transcendent, it is both. Okay. And so there's this, I don't remember where I was going with that.
Well, the both is the righteousness of God.
Right. The righteousness of God.
His righteousness, but also what he shares
exactly.
with us.
Exactly. And so, you know, how is God righteous within his own eternal community? If we've been invited into the eternal community, that there's this assumption, you know, it's kind of like if you were to, say, pick up a street kid, you know, some 13, 14-year-old runaway, somebody had been abused, and you want to take them in to your house. And your kids are still at home, you're raising them. And how do you welcome that person into your family and your home? You know, is there something that they're going to have to do to accommodate, right? Obviously, there is. And the rules themselves are, they kind of grow out of that. They may express the culture of your home, but you could probably boil all of your rules, your household rules, down to just a few things. Mm-hmm. You know, respect one another, consider each other.
It's like those kind of thing. Like those cute pieces of art people hang on their walls. These are our family rules. Love one another, laugh often, play hard.
Right.
You know, respect. Yeah.
Right. Right. Don't stay out till 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. Don't bring your girlfriend home. Mm-hmm. You know, those aren't on there. You know what I'm saying? Obviously, those rules begin to generate once people begin to disregard the cultural givens of a system. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so God has a set of cultural givens within himself. Mm-hmm. And, or maybe one, right? Faith working through love. Mm-hmm. That there is a relational trust and a giving of self that I think is the righteousness of God. Mm-hmm. And that the gospel reveals that on the human stage. Mm-hmm. This eternal moral code that may have been expressed through the Decalogue, you know, and the Torah, or at least those things reminded us where we had violated them, okay, violated that moral code. But the moral code itself has always been the faith of the Son. Mm-hmm. It's not like this was a new moral code that arrived, that God innovated. You know, the Sermon on the Mount is not Decalogue 2.0. Mm-hmm. Those are descriptors for this overarching value set that is the divine culture, the divine assumptions. And so when Adam goes to dethrone God, you know, he grasps at equality with God
rather than trusting God.
Right. That grasping in and of itself is the sin, not the particular eating of the fruit. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's the
transgression is
it.
The occasion. Mm-hmm. For acting out what was really going on under the surface.
Right. Right.
It's a circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the thing. When we talk about what Adam and Eve wanted was the knowledge of good and evil, that we think of good and evil in terms of ethics or morals, but I think that it was more about survival.
Good and bad.
Yeah. They wanted beneficial versus harmful. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know the full set of all things beneficial and harmful. They wanted the capacity to make the decisions for themselves, to self-direct without reference to God. So that's inherently unbelief. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's mistrust. That was already, I think, at least present in them before the actual committing of the error.
It seems to have been sown in them through the lie, through the lie that that serpent made, sort of like distrust emerged.
Sure. But, and this is something I've been wrestling with personally some, you know, but where would the trust be had the lie not come up? You know, can we trust if there's no test? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the gospel is the woven into the gospel is, you know, Eloi, lama sabachthani, right? Mm-hmm. That cry of dereliction is just as much the good news as the resurrection Sunday. But without that, you know, do we see the faith of the Son? Can mm-hmm. we possibly appreciate it without this extreme sacrifice and loss, the dereliction, the despair, the abandonment, you know, how far does somebody have to fall to demonstrate complete trust? Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about a trust fall, right? And in trust fall, you go past about 45 degrees and somebody catches you if they're strong. Mm-hmm. Should probably catch you sooner if you're bigger than they are. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we're talking about someone that just lets you smack into the earth and fall on through, you know. I mean, that's a trust fall to the uttermost. Mm-hmm. But only through that fall, you know, can the trustworthiness of the other be seen, and can the quality of trust, the degree of trust, be established? So I wonder, you know, had it not been for the enemy, and God uses Satan for his ends, you know, that's got to be super frustrating, you know. It's like every time you do something mm-hmm. to spite somebody or whatever, he's, mm-hmm. you know, you're just like, no, I've been waiting for you, you know, I got you right where I want you, kind of a thing. And, you know, but that, I mean, that is the God of the Bible. He's not locked in some controversy or struggle with his enemies. You know, they're just to their chagrin, I'm sure, doing everything that he's ordained that they would do, you know, despite themselves. So that's probably difficult to understand, you know. But at any rate, so sin, I think, sin is ultimately a failure to ascribe to God his due. I mean, that's to esteem God as he is. If we esteem God as he is, then obviously we trust him. And if we trust him, we esteem him as he is. Mm-hmm. So, and Paul wrestles with that. I mean, Paul's going around as somebody who's a very well-educated Jew, very observant Jew. I mean, I don't know if you can just, any of us can fully imagine or fully grasp what it would be like. Maybe the kids of the Duggars, the ones that are more, you know, that are more conforming to what they were given. But I don't know if we can fully grasp. The idea of the feeling of standing on the shoulders of generations of people who've believed exactly what you believe, who did exactly what you were taught to do, you know, who have a whole nation that is devoted to that. I don't know if we can fully grasp that. Even somebody raised in the most fundamentalist group or cult in the world only has probably one or two generations they can look back on. And those cults usually start to fall apart. You know, Mormonism has lasted quite a while in terms of, you know, compared to some of the others. And so I imagine, you know, there are some fourth and fifth generation Mormons out there who were raised to just know that this is the truth and everything else is false and it's true implicitly and you don't need to question it. Now, for one of those people to come along and, which, you know, we have people who are deconstructing Mormonism and that's one thing, but for somebody to come along and offer an alternative.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
Advocated Mormonism. For it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To advocate for it. Something that refutes or at least discards Joseph Smith, and you know, not doesn't discard it, but maybe relegates it to non-binding. You know, that's a massive jump. That's a huge shift. And so here's Paul coming along and welcoming in the Gentiles. That's just not done. You know, it's just, it's essentially wrong if you're a Jew in the first century. I mean, to be a Jew is to not be a Gentile. If you let the Gentiles in, you call the Gentiles Israel, what are you? Nothing. You know? I mean, you're just irrelevant.
You just gave up all our distinctiveness.
Yeah. Right. And that's the whole point of all of this.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone to all this trouble. I've been a vegetarian my whole life because I'm living out here in this pagan world. And I didn't want to accidentally eat meat that was sacrificed. And I'm just like Daniel, you know. And I would have loved to have some meat. You know, I would have loved to have eaten differently. I would have loved to have been accepted. I would have loved to have been a part of that guild and gotten these employment opportunities. But I couldn't because I'm trying to be faithful. And now you're telling me that those people can come in and it doesn't matter anymore. You know, how dare you say this, right? So for them to conform to Torah is to fulfill the will of God. That just has to, your mind begins to go there. It has to, right? And yet, Paul has to do some very intentional ethics as he's going along. He can't just undermine this. He can't just say it doesn't matter anymore. You know,
he's got to show why it doesn't matter anymore.
And he has to replace it with something more robust, something more substantial, and something that can be demonstrated from their own scriptures. This can't come in from the side. It can't just be a matter of pragmatics. This has to be something that their own Bible has been asking for, calling for, proclaiming, promising for the ages. Okay. And so he goes back to Adam, he goes to Abraham, you know, he goes back before the giving of the law to demonstrate that this experiment, that to be Israel isn't contingent on the law, because Israel existed before the law. So if Israel existed before the law, Israel was in a relationship with God, there must have been a standard, there must have been a cultural norm, some expectations built into that relationship. And so Paul points out that it was faith, right? You know, if you're a cynic and you say, well, Paul was making this stuff up, well, he found some very convenient passages, you know, in the Old Testament. Obviously, Genesis 15, 4, you know, Abram believed God and God counted it to him as righteousness. Why is that there? You know, if the whole point was
law keeping,
why build that? And why put it? I mean, the only requirement that Abraham was given was circumcision, as far as I'm aware. And that's Genesis 17. So, you know, there's Abraham standing there with a, you know, all the equipment he was born with. Counted righteous, you know. So that's significant to Paul. It's something that the Jews, I think, probably redacted. Like we talk about how young earth creationists kind of redact certain details from the Genesis story to create some cohesive worldview. I think that Israel had probably just not bothered to notice, you know, that Abraham was righteous before circumcision. So they're coming along declaring the uncircumcised unrighteous. How's that, you know? Paul defines God. He says that Abraham believed the God who justifies the ungodly. You know? So we're going around and we're saying, look at all these ungodly heathen, you know?
Their God justified the ungodly when he called Abraham and declared him righteous.
So who was in the tradition of Abraham? The believing Gentiles or the observant Jew?
Right. It's only the one who shares the faith of Abraham, Paul says.
Right.
Whether Jew or Gentile.
right? And his faith was to trust in the one who justifies the ungodly.
Mm-hmm. And he goes on to talk about the God who raises the dead, the God mm-hmm. who calls into being that which does not exist.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is that abandonment.
Yes.
Like just giving yourself over. There's nothing more I can do. It's going to have to be God.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, in the Abraham story, we get instances of Abraham committing sin. I mean, clearly, if we say the standard is faith, then every time he lied about Sarah, mm-hmm. you know, this was an act of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Having a child with Hagar. Mm-hmm. Obviously, these are all unbelieving actions,
mm-hmm.
and they all have consequences. And it's funny how the narrative is very straightforward. There's no indictment on Abraham, no expectation mm-hmm. that he would do differently. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not like, and Abraham was, I mean, God kind of sides with him, right? God upholds him, mm-hmm. even despite the fact of his failures, right? But God is cultivating this worthwhile faith mm-hmm. in him so that it's fulfilled. God's expectation of Abraham that he will have this fully formed faith comes true. It becomes real. It becomes real in his experience in his life. And so I think that we see what righteousness looks like as we watch Abraham counted righteous, but also becoming righteous. You know, this is a process. We see inklings of Abraham acting righteously, not accepting a bribe from the king of Sodom, you know, giving Lot first choice of the property, you know, where he's going. These kinds of things are acts of faith. So for Abraham, we see kind of a mix of faith and unfaith.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In Christ, we see the distilled version, right? The 200 proof faith that took all those years for Abraham to develop, but Christ has, from at least as we see him in the narrative, apparently from his baptism at least. So I think that is what righteousness is. So Paul, as he's talking about righteousness versus unrighteousness, this righteousness of God, he lays down the antithesis in verse 18. Romans 1, it says, "For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." Right? Which was, Habakkuk?
2:4.
2, something like that. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And I think it's 14.
I don't know. Maybe so.
Maybe. We'll go back and look. Anyway, "For the wrath of God is revealed." You know, we have subject headings and paragraph breaks and stuff like that in our translation. Sometimes that causes us to miss the close association of two ideas. One is the righteousness of God is revealed mm-hmm. by the gospel because the wrath of God is revealed. Okay. From heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Okay, so he's indicting the unbelieving world, right? What was the essence of why is God's wrath on these people? It is because of their ungodliness and their unrighteousness, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Okay, because what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them, etc., right? His physical, his invisible attributes are revealed by creation. Okay, they didn't honor God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Now, a lot of times people will read that the next several verses and what they will see is a litany of immorality or sin. Okay, that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's saying that these things, you know, that they gave themselves up to these perverse relationships and actions that they
leading to all manner of
leading
evil,
to all these all this unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness, their gossip, slanders, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, Yeah, disobedience to parents. Those are the wrath of God.
Mm-hmm. The wrath of God is revealed. I'm going to explain it to you. I'm going to describe it to you.
Right, right. So all of these things are symptoms, you know. But the disease is this ungodliness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it mm-hmm. is this failure to esteem God as he obviously is. And that is the essence of sin in every society. So I would say that anywhere you find violence or manipulation or coercion or any of these kinds of things that we would consider to be human evils, what they're rooted in is this aspiration to be as God, this desire to dethrone God, this ungodliness. And ungodliness and unrighteousness, I think that the unrighteousness and the ungodliness are the exact same act considered from two perspectives. One is, ungodliness is the essence of what they're doing, right? That they do not esteem God as he is,
mm-hmm.
okay? But it's unrighteousness in that it is defrauding God. That, you know, it's not just that it's dangerous for them, but it is an affront to God because God deserves this. You know, in his essence, in his nature, he compels it from his creation. If they fail to offer this heart of worship, devotion, trust to him, that they have defrauded him. So David, after his sin with Bathsheba in Psalm 51, you remember what he says, right?
Against you, you only have I sinned.
Right. What? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure Uriah the Hittite might have had, you know, some words about that. Why would he say that? What do you think?
Well, your point is that sin is in essentially a turning from God. And so David is seeing that what really went on there is he didn't trust God.
Right. Right. And I mean, Uriah's dead. He can't forgive him. You know, how will David find absolution if there is some sort of if God has to consider the implications of what David did to Uriah as he's meeting out judgment, you know? All that to say is that all sin is ultimately against God, but it's not like, it's not because God's given a moral law or prohibition. It's that sin is what we consider sin. Immoral actions are the outgrowth of this heart of discounting, despising God. And so that sin ultimately is that. Now, that tendency to despise God then is expressed in a disregard for if he gives a prescriptive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess that's where we're going with this, is that sin doesn't depend on prohibitions to exist.
Yeah. Somewhere in one of Paul's letters, Paul makes the point that sin was in the world before there was the law. So
right.
When you have the law, then you do have transgressions.
Mm-hmm.
You have acts of disobedience to the law.
Right.
But there was sin in the world before the law. Because
right.
There was this despising of God, distrusting of God,
mm-hmm.
going one's own way.
Right. Yeah. Well,
and that's original sin?
Yes. Well, I think when we'll get to that, I guess we'll get to that. Just give me one more. So mm-hmm. There's two versions of this ungodliness. There's one, there's a pagan version of the ungodliness, and that is this idolatry that leads to all of these other kind of lamentable behaviors and a devolving of society, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, most crackheads don't live a very affluent life. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah. Hunter Biden does,
right,
but
right,
there are
other
those
than
who
that,
don't.
Right, other than that, yeah.
Most don't.
Right, 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 yeah. So, you know, sins seem to have immediate consequences, or at least real world consequences here,
mm-hmm.
right? And so someone might, if you lived in a family that was the product of multi-generational sin, Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know if you've been around people who, you know, they came from a broken home that, you know, and that they're, because their parents came from some abusive family who came from some, you know, on mm-hmm. down. And so those people are living very, very poorly most of the time, mm-hmm. right? Crime, addictions, all kinds of mental illness, everything is kind of the result of this multi-generational sin, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you could look, if you were somebody who, let's say you were an observant Jew in the first century, mm-hmm. and you have been the beneficiary of multi-generational blessing and being a part of a community that has had to look out for its own. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we see this with Jews today, right? In every society, they rise to the top and, you know, people resent them and persecute them for that. But there's a reason that they do, mm-hmm. okay? And a lot of it has to do with a strong sense of community, tradition, strong sense of family. All of that's going to promote a lot of well-being and flourishing in your life here, mm-hmm. okay? And so what if you were a first century Jew and you were living among a bunch of pagans who are wallowing in their own filth?
Right. You're going to look down on them. You're going to be very self-righteous.
Right. And so he says, therefore, you have no excuse, O man, every one of you who judges. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself because the judge, practice the very same things. Mm-hmm. Does this mean that he was saying you Jews are involved in all this litany of immorality? I don't think so. I think he's saying you are guilty of the same ungodliness when you put yourself on God's throne. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a grasping at godhood, using the law as a ladder mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. climb, you know, mm-hmm. and I will rise. I will be like the Most High. Mm-hmm. And so the law itself becomes the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And so people continue to live that out. Even in being a conforming Jew who judges other people mm-hmm. committed the exact same sins, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm. okay.
Which,
so that was the other side of ungodliness and unrighteousness, is the religious version of it.
Exactly.
Self-righteousness.
Exactly. And so, there's this double bind around the law. Somebody who disregards it ends up in, you know, this hedonistic filth. Someone who hyper conforms to it ends up, you know, in this ugly Pharisaic mode mm-hmm. that nobody wants to be a part of, mm-hmm. right? So, and so Paul goes on in chapter 3 and says everybody's guilty, mm-hmm. right? And
under sin,
mm-hmm. right? Right. And so everybody's done it. Everybody's committed sins. I mean, when somebody becomes so hyper observant of a law, I don't know if you've been around very legalistic groups, but there's always this seedy underbelly of immorality. You know, every place there's whitewashed walls, there are dead men's bones every time. So, yeah, we can assume that they are also engaged in secret immorality as well. But the essence of their sin is this tendency to judge others. Okay. And so that becomes a problem. So how do we get people to righteousness? If I can't legislate behavior without somebody taking it and using it as a cudgel on somebody else, mm-hmm. you know, and I can't just leave people to their own devices, how do I bring people to righteousness? What could possibly do it? Right. And so he says, but now the righteousness of God, and he returns to that in Romans 3:21, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He returns to that theme, the righteousness of God. So he's really bookended it. 1:17, therein is revealed the righteousness of God. Now we get this crap sandwich, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? That the filling is all the sin of humankind, mm-hmm. okay? And then we get to 3:21, and he takes up the theme of the righteousness of God. He says, the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. It has to be, because we will always abuse the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, so we can't discount it, right? The righteousness of God through the faith of Jesus Christ mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for all who believe, mm-hmm. for there is no distinction. For all have sinned and what falls short of the glory of God. Mm-hmm. That's what sin is. Mm-hmm. It's this falling short of the glory of God. That's what Adam's invited into. Bringing it back you know, this idea of the glory of God. This is what we're supposed to aim toward. You see, because this self-righteousness is never the glory of God. It's always relative. It's not even close to the glory of God. Legalism can never bring anyone toward the glory of God. Only through the faith of the Son can somebody aspire in that direction and make progress in that direction. And so we get this, that's the goal, that's the standard. Okay. And so in Romans 5, Paul takes up this idea of original sin and Adam. And so he says in Romans 5:12, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man and death through sin, so death spread to all men because all sinned. I'm reading from the ESV, so I'm using sexist language here. So, therefore, sin came into the world through one man and death through sin. So death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given. But sin is not counted where there is no law. Okay, so there's not this infraction. So why give the law, right? Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the meaning of type, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, original sin is closely related to that idea of type.
Right.
Adam represents us, and we sinned in Adam.
Right, right, exactly. So
although does Paul say that there? Because Paul talks about how sin came into the world through Adam and death through sin. And then does he say, and thus all sinned? He actually says, because all sinned.
Right.
I think it's interesting. I always thought it was interesting that he actually acknowledges that all people themselves sin. Mm-hmm.
But does he mean that all sinned through Adam? We don't know.
Yeah, it's a little bit unclear.
Yeah.
All sinned in Adam.
Right.
Or all sinned in their lives, demonstrating that indeed sin and death were in the world since the time of Adam.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
But I want to notice this idea that death reigned from Adam to Moses. I think he's saying that all did sin, but it wasn't counted, right? But why did they sin? I would say that for Paul, death is this alienation from God and this disintegration of self that passed to all people. Mm-hmm. Everyone was born alienated from God. Cain, Abel, and because of that, we're subject to this fracturing of the self. So Cain offers a sacrifice. God has no regard for it. He was down, he was indignant or whatever. His face was downcast. That is the experience of death. You know, Cain is guilty of ungodliness. I don't think there's any wonder as to why God gave regard to Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. I think that Cain's sacrifice is offered as just, the leftovers. We were clearly told that Abel offered some of the first of his flock and Cain brought some of the fruit of the ground. Mm-hmm. So it seems that the distinction there isn't so much that God, is a carnivore and not a vegetarian, but that Abel's sacrifice was rooted in godliness and adoration, whereas Cain's was perfunctory, obligatory, whatever you want to call it. And so God didn't regard it. But that disregard, that alienation, led to a fracturing within Cain, as he has this, we're told what it's very explicit that his experience is having this downcast face, right? That he's upset, and that makes him vulnerable to sin. That God doesn't say, now, I haven't given you guys this law yet, but I probably should, so don't kill your brother. I mean, he doesn't say that. says sin's waiting at the door. It wants to have you. Mm-hmm. You know? So Paul, I think that Cain is experiencing this death through this alienation, this dissonance, and that is what reigned from Adam to Moses. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that because of that alienation and that dissonance, that Cain commits the sin, even though there's no prohibition. So God doesn't prescribe any sort of, you know, a life for a life punishment on Cain. Mm-hmm. You know, that he's banished further and all that. There are some consequences to his actions, but those have to do with more like spiritual laws, like the fact that Abel's blood is crying from the ground. You know, whatever that means, it seems to be some sort of moral pollution of the planet that didn't require a prohibition against murder to still be sin. Mm-hmm. You know,
because it arose from unbelief. And it was an act of, it was an unloving act, mm-hmm. arising from unbelief.
Right. And that unbelief expressed itself first as ungodliness, as a disregard for God, mm-hmm. and then had implications for the interpersonal, for intrapersonal, how a person sees themselves, and then an interpersonal action that causes pollution to creation. Okay, so there's this multi-layered mm-hmm. growth of sin that comes. But again, there's not been a single prohibition. That through all of that, Cain has not transgressed even once. I don't know if we really, when we read that story, because we read back into it, mm-hmm. the prohibition against murder. Mm-hmm. But Cain's committed no transgressions. Mm-hmm. And that is to Paul's point. That sin doesn't need transgression. So we have to get
sin
off
was in the
this,
world.
Right. We have to get off this legal metaphor, this moralistic idea that God's all bent out of shape if you don't conform to the rules, or, you know, that's his major concern. That, you know, what did Paul mean when he wrote that? Does that include dancing? You know, does that mean that, you know, what should I kiss my girlfriend, or, you know, maybe we should, and we get really concerned over these things that I guess must grow out of our own need to know that we're right without having to just surrender ourselves completely. Honestly, I think that's what legalism is, trying to make sure we're going to be okay eternally without really surrendering ourselves. Which, again, gets back to that fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It really is the antithesis of the righteousness of God, ironically. Legalism, moralism, it's not something like, well, that's unfortunate, maybe they could learn better, but it is straight up defiance, just wearing a cowardly cloak, and we should have no use for it. To be honest, I think oftentimes people who are more progressive or more tolerant of people to, you know, we're always more tolerant of the people to the right of us, you know, mm-hmm. and less to the people of the left. And but Paul was, I think, practically speaking, to the left of the Orthodox Jews of his mm-hmm. days. Mm-hmm. And he was very intolerant of them, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that if we're going to uphold the Pauline gospel, that the one thing you must not do is be a legalist. You know, it's like, he was like, guys, now you need to quit going down and sleeping with the prostitutes at the pagan temple. You know, don't do that. But with the Galatians, he was like, what is wrong with you? You know, is your brain broken? Because he saw that really out of that legalism comes a whole host of evils and, just horrors, you know, in people's lives. And so even the giving of the law wasn't supposed to supplant the life of faith. It was supposed to express it. But because you can follow the law without the faith of the Son, then it becomes something abominable.
So the point of this today's discussion is redefining original sin.
Yeah.
And we're saying that you're redefining it. You're making a point that it's not to be understood as the breaking of law.
It was the breaking of law. Yes. Yes, it was the breaking
the
of
original
a law.
Sin the original was the breaking sin. Of a law.
Right.
A command.
Right.
Which put us in a position born into of an approach to life. Which means everybody after that is born into an approach to life of distrust, ungodliness.
Right. Well, we're all born alienated from God. Mm-hmm. Just like the people outside the garden when Cain was like, don't send me out there among those people. You know, we're like them, right? And so that's the spiritual death that everyone's born into. And because they are born into that, they're going to die physically, but they're also going to stay dead physically. They're going to commit sins because of that alienation and perform horrific acts. And even if they're given a moral code, they're going to either violate it or use it to harm others, or both, most likely. So that's the state that we find ourselves in.
And what God has given us as rescue out of that state is the faith of the Son.
Right.
Who was the one to come. Adam was a type of the one to come. And by being in Jesus, the one that it was to come, we are rescued out of that death and out of the domination of sin.
Exactly. You know, people who have a problem with original sin, they fail to notice or to attend to the fact that they would do exactly what Adam did. That there isn't a person on this planet who would default to trusting God. It's just how, I think it's just the fact of where we are.
Right.
You know, if we're given the opportunity to have all the answers up front and just make our own choices, we're going to do it. So God used Adam as the problem. You know, how do you allow one man to be the redemption for all people? One righteous act to count as righteousness for all people, unless their problem is that one ungodly act, one sinful act, put them in their predicament. So,
thank you, Nathan. Much to chew on there, guys. We'll see you next time. You can always email us your questions at discussion@recoverfaith.org.